a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. I want to call to order the Interim Rules Committee. I want to welcome all of you in attendance this morning. I would ask the Secretary to call the roll, please.
Buell.
Here.
Gibson.
Here.
Hunt.
Here.
Torino.
Here.
Valley.
Here.
Hunhoff.
Here.
Have a quorum.
Thank you. The minutes are before you from our last meeting. I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Representative Hunt, seconded by Senator Buell. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Thank you. Staff, do you have anything to report?
Just one item. If anyone is here for the state fire marshal rules, Department of Public Safety, the fire marshal or someone from the office has asked that the rules be moved to the next committee meeting in June. Those rules will not be presented today. Also, the J.J. Lynn of the Electrical Commission is also not on the agenda today. They're going to be rescheduled for the next committee also.
Great. Thank you. Just a reminder for those of you that are present today, if you are going to speak, I would ask you to please sign in. Those that are speaking, please do not be redundant. If someone has shared your same thoughts, just add to those if you're going to provide testimony with that. One last thing. I'm going to give you a tip of the day. You know, I'm a healthcare professional, and I just got an email. One of the leading causes of death is stroke. So sometimes you encounter someone, you're at a party, somebody trips and falls, and I'm going to give you three tips. It's called STR to determine if someone could be experiencing a stroke. First, ask the person to smile. Secondly, ask them to say a simple sentence. And third, ask them to raise both arms. If they can't do any one of those three that I just said, please get them to an emergency room because you have a time of approximately, in my mind here,
3 hours.
3 hours. Somebody saw the email. So 3 hours to respond. So that's your tip of the day if you're with anyone. Thank you. With that, we will appropriately move to the Department of Health Board of Pharmacy, since anticoagulants are one of the things you do when somebody has a stroke immediately. So with those people present, please come for the Board of Pharmacy for Prescription Drug Monitoring Rule Program.
I'm Ron Heater from the Board of Pharmacy here to speak on behalf of the administrative rules for the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. These rules were developed to support the law that was enacted as of July 1st a year ago, 3420E. And in the process of doing this, we had several meetings of the Advisory Council that was established in that law. And we had a rules hearing on March 15th. We've been working in consultation with the Attorney General's office to make sure that the rules we've adopted are legal, because there's a lot of sensitive issues related to private health information. And we think the rules that we have presented now are consistent and in support of that law and appropriate for the program. And I'll be glad to answer questions.
Are there questions from the committee? See none. Are there any other proponents then? Any other proponents? Any other proponents? Seeing none, thank you. Are there any opponents? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brett Kennecke. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I'm appearing here today on behalf of the South Dakota State Medical Association. The Medical Association has been involved in and has provided some limited assistance to the Board of Pharmacy and the Advisory Committee as they've prepared the draft of the rules in front of you. The Medical Association remains concerned about patient privacy in this day and age. As these rules move forward, we'd like to point out that people are entitled to rights to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. They're entitled to have their medical records be secure under HIPAA and under our professional guidelines in this state. We question whether the rules as drafted fully recognize those rights. And we want to go on record as saying that we're intending to remain vigilant as the process moves forward to ensure that patient rights and privacy are protected to the extent necessary and required under the law. So with that, thank you very much this morning. I'll remain for any questions you might have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Valley.
Could you maybe expound a little bit where you think these rules may violate that?
It would be our position that under the federal law known as HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability Protection Act, that permitted disclosures to law enforcement are restricted in the federal code. And I would say that I think it remains to be seen whether the Board of Pharmacy follows both the rules and the regulations of the federal government and the rules that they've promulgated and put forward here. There are permitted disclosures under HIPAA, if I can cite, disclosures for law enforcement purposes as required by law, including laws require the reporting of certain types of wounds or injuries. That's not reflected, to my recollection, in the rules that are put forth before you. In compliance with a court order or court-ordered warrant, subpoena, or summons issued by a judicial officer, that part did make it through. So I think there's some overlap there that I'm not sure is going to be recognized, and I simply came here, Senator, this morning to remind people that the Medical Association does take that seriously and we are going to remain vigilant.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Do you feel they're in conflict, the federal rules and these rules?
I don't feel they're necessarily in conflict, no. I think it might turn out to be a conflict as the individual requests come in and the process moves forward. I think there's a possibility that there's a conflict on an individual circumstance basis going forward.
Thank you.
Any other question? Senator Buell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there is a conflict going forward, then what would be, are there liabilities that the state is opening itself up to, or what do you see as the steps down the road?
It would be my, thank you, Senator, it would be my position that there'd be remedies for the individual in terms of either in the criminal process, they would have an opportunity to litigate whether their records were properly searched. On the civil side, I believe that the HIPAA laws provide for individual remedies that people could then pursue.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a question. On page 4, is this the issue you're relating, the disclosure of data by law enforcement? I mean, is that your specific reference?
Yes, that would be.
Just a question. If just in my understanding, it says related to controlled substances that may request for the purpose of investigation or prosecution of drug-related activity. Is that now what's out there? And when they are accessing information that currently is processed and it's health information that can be accessed in this route for those two intents?
Thank you, Senator. That might be a question better addressed to the law enforcement agencies who are here. It would be the Medical Association's position that the PDMP, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, and the data included in there not be a place where the law enforcement organizations can start a search or start their investigation of someone for illegal purposes, but that they can refer to that to help build the case later on, given the safeguards that are found in law. Go get a subpoena, go get a search warrant, and then ask for the records. I hope I've helped you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Are there any other opponents? Any other opponents? Okay, Representative Torno, you had a question of one of the proponents.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Heater, I believe. Sir, as I look at 2051-3204, access to data, I'm wondering, I guess, a couple of things. What would the definition be for the purpose of providing patient health care? For instance, and I notice this could be for doctors and or pharmacies, would it constitute the purpose of providing health care if such a person were to compare data from another person? That is, they might have seen someone with a similar condition. Would they have a right then to access that other person's history within the system and compare, but maybe not take any action?
Representative Turnow, I think that's a hard question to answer. I think the intent here is that...
I'm going to stop you. Do you have your mic on?
Sorry. Representative Turnow, I think that's a good question. The intent here is access records if that is their patient. Now, they cannot access a record to compare a patient that they're not taking care of to help, you know, make a determination on the patient that they're caring for today. I think that's something that prescribers perhaps do sometimes among their patient population, is to see what has worked for another patient and then apply that knowledge to a patient they're treating today. But they cannot access data on someone that they've not taken care of.
So it's your testimony, you could not, it would not fall under the definition of for the purposes of providing health care to do that comparative analysis?
Only if the two patients they were comparing were both their own patients.
Okay. Follow up?
Go ahead.
Then within that same rule, I guess I'm curious, why would it fall under the board's authority to conduct regular reviews of data access by practitioners to identify potential violations of law if you're talking about doctors? I would understand as to pharmacists, but this is written broadly enough that you could actually report a doctor. Isn't that true?
Yes, and I think the statute gives that authority to this program.
Nothing further.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you. You've indicated that the healthcare practitioners would be restricted to only their own patients, in essence. I don't see that limitation, though, in this provision.
Well, that would be, to me, that's a given. The HIPAA states that that's the way it has to be. I don't think we need to repeat that in this law. And in the process of obtaining information from the program, the procedure that will be in place is each and every time a healthcare practitioner wants to access patient data, they're essentially signing off electronically in the process, stating that this is my patient, I'm providing medical care for this patient. And 3420E already says that if it's not their patient, it's a class 6 felony.
So you're saying that the statutory authority, and I don't have it in front of me, I apologize. You're saying the statutory authority requires that they state that this information is only for their use for their particular patient?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is someone from the Attorney General's office in the room?
Yes, the Attorney General is here.
Could I ask him a question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your question.
Mr. Attorney General, on 2051-3208, disclosure of data to law enforcement, and it says, for the purpose of an investigation or prosecution of the drug-related activity or probation compliance of an individual, the board shall verify the status of the law enforcement or prosecutorial official with the appropriate authority. What does that mean?
Madam Chairman. Representative Gibson, the way we interpret that to mean is essentially that there needs to be a confirmation that the law enforcement officer is, in fact, an appropriate law enforcement officer, whether that be through DCI or otherwise, to ensure that you don't have essentially an identity theft situation.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Attorney General, do you feel that this particular statute violates federal HIPAA regulations?
Madam Chairman, let me give you a general answer. The answer is no, and the reason is this. When you look at the federal law, some of which was cited to you, there are exceptions in 45 CFR subsection 203. There are three specific subsections that apply to prescription drug management programs. In fact, when the legislature first passed prescription drug monitoring, there were approximately 40 states with monitoring programs in the works, about 35 that are presently operational, that fall within the three exceptions to HIPAA. One of the exceptions my good friend Mr. Kennecke mentioned, and that is a provision of state law provides for reporting of disease or injury, but the key part is or for the conduct of public health surveillance, investigation, or intervention. That's 45 CFR 160-203, subsection C. I'm not going to go into detail on the other two, but there are three HIPAA exceptions that clearly fall within the prescription drug monitoring program. We have also had a judge in South Dakota similarly rule, and I'll just quickly read the quote from the judge. And this was in the Huber decision that's currently on trial right now, and hereon it was reversed for other reasons. Quote, the court sees a significant difference between the medical records of an individual and the prescription records involving controlled substances and prescription drugs. The controlled drug industry is pervasively regulated at the present time and has been for a significant amount of time. The state has a substantial police power interest in regulating prescription drugs and controlled drugs. The South Dakota legislative scheme restricts those records appropriately, and it prohibits public dissemination of that information. There is no objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in those records held by the individual whose records they are, and therefore, the gathering of use of prescription drug information as done by the state in this case does not violate the privacy interests protected by the Fourth Amendment. So we have both federal law exceptions in HIPAA, we have a South Dakota court decision, and we clearly have a statutory scheme that is set forth with specific reference to SDCL 34-20B-57 that would make this a legal process.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Jackling.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Torino.
Thank you. Attorney General Jackley, I guess I'm trying to follow then how you square, and I guess I do have a question under 8, why we wouldn't put in the provision based upon a subpoena, especially in light of 3420E7, sub 7. And it says that the board may provide data in the central repository to any judicial authority under grand jury subpoena or court order or equivalent judicial process for investigation of criminal violations of controlled substances laws. Why would that provision be there if a subpoena was not necessary?
Madam Chair, I think for two reasons. I'm going to talk to you about the practical reason first. When we start dealing with, say, grand jury subpoenas or court-authorized subpoenas, warrants, that is a very disruptive process. When law enforcement shows up or forces a doctor or pharmacist to go before a grand jury and wait for several hours, it becomes a very disruptive process, an important process at times. We have a statute directly on point, SDCL 34-20B-57, that says, quote, the Department of Health shall, in addition to other powers and duties vested in it by the chapter or any other act, arrange for the exchange of information between government officials concerning the use and abuse of drugs and substances. There would be no reason for that statute if you were only going to require there to be grand jury subpoenas or warrants. And I go back to, you know, certainly we can engage in that conduct, but that would be extremely disruptive for doctors, for pharmacists, for patients, and would take a considerable amount of resources. So we fall back and rely upon that Section 57, Representative.
Go ahead. So is it your contention that 3420E7, sub 7, is only applicable to grand jury subpoenas? Because it does say, or court order, or equivalent judicial process for investigation.
Madam Chair, that's fair, but common the common or a investigative tool that would be used would be the grand jury subpoena. I mean, typically that's, you know, that grand jury is an investigative body that we would likely be using it in that context. I mean, certainly you can use it in other contexts, getting court orders, et cetera, but oftentimes that would be the practical process when law enforcement is in the process of an investigation. That's what our grand jury is for.
Just a follow-up. Is the intent here that you're saying that the information that would be in this database would be exempted, as you gave the exemptions for HIPAA, that this information would not be, would be exempted? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Madam Chair, the use of the word exempted, I mean, I think it's fair that it's exempted in relation to medical practitioners, pharmacists, and law enforcement. I don't know that we go further than that. So I think in relation to those categories, I think that information is exempt under, and I will maybe take this opportunity to read the other two federal HIPAA exemptions. If it is necessary, one, to prevent fraud and abuse related to the provisions of health care, or two, for purposes of serving a compelling need related to public health. And so I think by that exception, that equals law enforcement and medical practitioners and pharmacists. So I think if you limit that, that you can say that the exemptions apply to those areas, the answer would be yes. The second exemption is if it has its principal purpose, the regulation of the distribution, dispensing, or the control of any controlled substance as defined under federal or state law, and that is 45 CFR section 160.203A2. So to answer your question is yes, as it applies to those particular areas.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Buell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Attorney General, can you maybe explain for the committee what exactly motivated the program coming now and what the process has been leading up to how we got to this point?
Madam Chair, this has been in the works for several years, and last year it really came to a head. We had a situation in Rapid City where there was a death. There were some other very serious matters. We were able to show on the law enforcement end over a three-year look-back period a tripling of prescription drug abuse. So the legislature basically worked through a program. And I talked before about how 40 states presently have in place prescription drug monitoring programs. So we were becoming essentially a safe haven for lack of monitoring. And there were a couple of options available. You had the law enforcement option, the red states such as California, Texas, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, the Attorney General runs a program. I had asked the legislature as Attorney General to look more towards a prevention program rather than a prosecution program, so that it would basically be a program that gave doctors and pharmacists access to real-time information, that they could go on if they were about to prescribe medications or they were about to dispense of medications, they could go online and see whether somebody is doctor shopping. It's important to remember that this is a prevention scheme, not a prosecution scheme, because in that instance, if the doctor goes on and sees that the patient appears to be doctor shopping, the doctor has a choice. The doctor can either report that to law enforcement or the doctor can send the patient on their way, so that we really wanted it to be something that the docs and pharmacists were comfortable using so that they can actually go online and check whether or not somebody should appropriately be given medication. That's what the purpose of this program is. It made sense to have the pharmacy board run the program. They're in the medical field. They are part of the Department of Health. That's where I think a majority of the prescription drug monitoring programs are run out of. There was essentially a strong consensus in the medical community and all the government agencies, perhaps with the exception of the Medical Association that you heard from Mr. Kennecke. I think it's fair to say that there was a consensus that this made the best sense to have a prevention over prosecution scheme run by the Board of Pharmacy. We've all along felt that this is a good plan that will give the doctors the ability to do the right thing.
Representative Torno.
Thank you. Mr. Heater, I wanted to follow up on a question I asked and Representative Hunt followed up on. As I look at 3420E7, sub 1, you said that for the purposes of providing patient care would only be to deal with that person's patient. However, and you said that was provided for under 3420E. But I see under that provision it says a prescriber or dispenser could access the program inquiring about the prescriber or dispenser's own prescribing activity. That wouldn't deal only with your own patient, would it?
Well, if it's their own prescribing or dispensing activity, it would be information about the patients they have either prescribed controlled drugs for or patients that they have dispensed them for.
So then you would say under that provision they could do that comparative analysis if they had both been patients they had dealt with, even though the two patients were not the same.
Representative Turnow, that would be correct. But what I meant earlier was if the second patient wasn't immediately in front of them today, provided it had been a patient they had seen prior, they could compare that record.
And then the other provision, and I'm just curious your thoughts, the other provision under 3420E7 sub 1 says that a prescriber or dispenser can access the program in order to further the purposes of the program. What does that mean?
Well, the purposes of the program are intended to provide better medication care to patients. And in order to provide good care to their patients, sometimes they need to look at that patient's history. And they need to compare not just what they as a prescriber have prescribed for that patient, but is that patient also getting prescriptions prescribed by other doctors?
One last follow-up. Okay. But isn't it also true a purpose of the program pursuant to these rules is the disclosure of data to law enforcement or other agencies as well?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Just a follow-up question again, and please understand, I fully support the basic concept of what we're doing here, but that old unintended consequences is the issue that I have. And as I look at 3420E-20, and I look at subsection 5 under that 3420E-20. Subsection 5 says that the board shall promulgate rules, in essence, that will provide guidelines for maintaining the confidentiality of program information and the integrity of the patient's relationship with the patient's health care provider. And I think that's what you were probably referring to when you answered my question before, that supposedly the doctor can only get information about his particular patient. But what I see, the first sentence or the first word in that phrase said these rules are supposed to provide guidelines for maintaining that. And so when I look at the first sentence of 04 here, access to data on page 2, Rule 20-51-32-04, access to data, and I see that sentence that says the healthcare providers that are authorized to prescribe or dispense controlled substances may request online access to the data for the purpose of providing patient health care. My thought is that that's a fair statement, but it almost needs a limiting factor. In other words, as to the provider's respective patient or something to that effect in order to provide, in my estimation, a better guideline for maintaining that confidentiality. So I don't disagree with that first sentence, but I think it really needs some further addition to ensure that we're only talking about a doctor with his patients or her patients, as the case might be. And you know, I'm not going to vote not to approve these rules because of that, but I would certainly encourage you to take a good look at whether or not the board is really meeting the requirements of providing the guidelines to do that. And that was my concern. So if you just take that on board and take it back to the board and go from there, I would appreciate that.
Thank you.
Just a follow-up question to that. For practitioners that do prescriptive authority, they can be in multiple settings. They can be in their clinic, they can be in their hospital, they can be in an ED department. They do not have a system that's currently available that they can look up Jean Hunhoff and to know that if she was at ED, I prescribed this, if she was at the clinic, this, because they don't have access to that information. So the database would only provide them that if Jean Hunhoff went to an ED, went to a clinic, went to a community clinic, that would be compiled and they could then track where Jean Hunhoff has been, because currently there is nothing out there to allow them to do that. Is that correct?
Senator Hunhoff, that is correct. The database would have any controlled substance prescription that a patient has filled with a South Dakota licensed pharmacy.
One other question. It has to do with a practitioner accessing only that patient information. Any type of setting that that practitioner is in, no matter what, they are part of HIPAA, applies to everything. So no matter what setting, they could not access someone else's patient information because they would be knowingly in violation of HIPAA. So they could only access their own patients, and that's being tracked by whatever organization they're operating with or working within. Is that correct?
Senator Hunhoff, just a little bit of clarification on that. If that prescriber has gone through the approval process to have access to data, they can request data on anyone in the database. However, each and every time they request data, they are signing off saying, this is my patient. I am providing care to this patient. And when they and then they will get the information. And if it's found that they have been getting data on patients that they're not actively involved in their care, the system will maintain those records for 3 years. If a patient feels that somebody has been inappropriately accessing their data, we will know each and every time somebody accessed who they were, and that information will be available to the patient. So if there was inappropriate access, then it can be followed up with. And prescribers and pharmacists will be educated to know that that could put their license at risk. They could be subject to a criminal charge if they do that.
One last question. Any time that a patient's information is inappropriately released or somebody accesses it that does not have authority, healthcare providers have to notify that patient. Is that what you are just saying here, that if Dr. Jones, who is not my doctor, accessed that I would be notified that Dr. Jones did that, or there's not a monitoring system built into that?
Senator Hunhoff, we won't necessarily know if it was appropriate or inappropriate, because that prescriber is stating, this is my patient. We would only follow up on that if we had a report to us that someone was inappropriately accessing data.
Thank you. Representative Torno.
Thank you. And that just hits upon, I guess, my question. How would I as a patient know if someone was inappropriately accessing it? I understand there could be circumstances where something really comes to light that I would say, hey, maybe I should ask that question. But going about my daily life, how would I have any idea that some other doctor other than my doctor might be accessing my information?
Representative Turnall, you may not know that, but there, from information that we learned from other states, one of the signs might be that your doctor refuses to give you a prescription, and you wonder, well, why is that? And you may contact us to find out, is there information in the database that would be detrimental to you?
Would I be able to inquire of my doctor to ask him or her to check to see if others have been accessing my records?
Representative Turnall, no, you would have to contact the program to determine that. Your doctor would not know who is accessing those records.
Madam Chair, just one question.
Go ahead.
Your rules provide that the board's going to conduct regular reviews of data access. How often is regular in the minds of the board? Is it every month? Is it every so many months, every year? What are you anticipating?
Representative Hunt, that's a good question, and until we get into the program, we're not gonna know. We do learn a lot from the other almost 40 states that are already doing this and finding out some of their processes, and we're already involved in meetings with them and discussions to find out what works for them and what we need to do in order to do this right.
But I would assume it would be less than a couple of years. I mean, I would assume you would be doing reviews almost on some sort of a quarterly basis or something along those lines, if you're really going to be effective in stopping what's going on. Is that an assumption that's...
Representative Hunt, yes, we will. As soon as we have several months' data collected, we will start doing reviews.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Valley.
There's no record of who all my health care provider doctor practitioners are, so that the system would know. I mean, I may get a new doctor, I may drop one because I didn't think he was doing a good job or whatever. So there's no list out there for Mike Valley that says this is his list of doctors, and anyone else comes in here, there's going to be an alarm go off or whatever. There's no way of knowing that. Would I be correct?
Senator Valley, yes, you're correct. The only information that will go into this database would be if you actually have a controlled drug prescription filled at a pharmacy. If you go to a doctor and they prescribe a blood pressure medicine, that doesn't go into this database. And so you may have other prescribers that don't show up in this list. If your doctor runs a report on your controlled drug prescriptions, the only things that will show up will be the controlled drug prescriptions, where you had the prescription filled, which doctor prescribed it, the drug you received, the quantity, that type of information.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was right in line with the question I wanted to ask, and that was the clarification that just controlled substances are in the database. Is that correct?
Representative Gibson, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Last call. Any other questions? Sort of through the questions period here, we've had a rebuttal. I'll let you have a very few minutes to, if you have anything else you want to add for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Senator Hanoff. The other comment I would make, because we there's a very active organization called the Alliance of States with Prescription Drug Monitoring Programs that provides opportunities to share information and learn from other states. And as you probably know, we're operating the first 2 years on a federal grant through the Department of Justice, which really funds attending these meetings to learn what's happening in other states. A lot of the processes now that will go from here that fine-tune the how the requests will be made, and that will help us ensure that that prescribers and dispensers know that it's access for their patients only, and that helps educate law enforcement that their requests better be appropriate. We'll be doing that, and we think that, again, when 40 other states are doing it and we're not hearing a lot of problems and concerns, it seems that these programs work, and we intend to do it the way the successful ones do it so that we don't have problems.
Thank you. I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion or action by the committee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gibson.
Could I ask Mr. Heater what the amount of that federal grant is, just out of curiosity for public knowledge?
Sure.
Yes, Representative Gibson, that's a good question. We have a grant of $400,000 for the period of October 1 of 2010 running through September 30th of 2012, and we're confident that will fully fund the startup and the full implementation of the program through September 30th of 2012.
Thank you so much. And Madam Chair, then I will move due pass on these sets of rules.
It's been moved by Representative, I don't know, I'm at a loss here. My mind went blank.
Gibson,
thank you. To do pass on the prescription drug monitoring program, is there a second?
Second
by Representative Hunt. Any discussion on that motion? Comments, I should say.
I think that this is a good start, Madam Chair, to get South Dakota online with the prescription drug monitoring program, and since they have 40 other states to as a source of reference and the federal grant, I think it's only appropriate that in lieu of the prescription drug problem in this country to start controlling or start monitoring our controlled substances, and I think it's in the proper hands, and with the Attorney General's help and blessing on this issue, I think this is a great program to get started in South Dakota.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
I appreciate the comments on behalf of the South Dakota Medical Association, but I think that every time we adopt rules or adopt laws, as far as that's concerned, we have to put them out there, and then we have to be alert to any potential problems. And I think that there's obviously some evidence of cooperation here between various groups of the medical community, and with all of them being on the alert to any problems that these rules might impose. I think that's good. I think we can go forth with the program, and everybody's aware of it, and I think it could very well be a plus for many of our communities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Buell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While I'm somewhat disinclined to rely on individual remedies for privacy concerns for patients, I do appreciate the prevention versus prosecution model, and I do think this is a good jumping off point for us, and I also expect that we'll be tweaking things down the road as we put this into practice.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Valley.
I want to thank the Medical Association for coming forward, and I'm sure they'll remain vigilant. But I remember when this was before us, and I voted for it. I think it's something that needs to be done. A very good case was made, and I think we need to get rolling down the track. So I agree with the other folks that this is something that we need to find a solution to, and I think we're there. And if you we're a member of an association of 40 other people, so we won't reinvent the wheel, and make sure that the wheel stays round. So thank you.
Thank you. Did you have anything? With that, the motion before you is do pass on prescription drug monitoring. Those in favor of the motion will signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Buell.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Torno.
No.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Motion carried. Thank you very much. With that, we'll move to our next item on the agenda, which we aren't going to have today, the Electrical Commission. So I will turn this over to Senator Buell.
The next rules we'll hear are from the Division of Insurance. If we could have someone from the department come and give us some background. Mr. Moses.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Randy Moses, Division of Insurance. With permission, I'll just run through the entire package and stand by for questions after that. The first part of the rules deals with Medicare supplement insurance. For a number of years, we've had requirements on the books as far as what is required on the applications for insurance. What we had found recently in doing some examinations of insurance companies that there are a certain minority of agents that for whatever reason just weren't completing the information. The questions were there. They just, for whatever reason, were not completing them. And that serves to the detriment of the consumers that that are purchasing these policies, because those questions are there designed for their protection to ensure that we don't have duplication of policies, that we don't have unwarranted replacements of Medicare supplement insurance. So these rules simply require the agents to complete the questions that are already there. The next rule deals with continuing education. That simply corrects an incorrect cross-reference. And then we have some similar rules on long-term care insurance, and they do the exact same thing for long-term care insurance that the first set of rules does for Medicare Supplement, and that is require those agents to complete those same kinds of questions on long-term care insurance applications. We also have a rule dealing with a cross-referenced problem with the limited benefit plans. The modification is to correct that incorrect cross-reference. The next set, which is fairly lengthy, deals with mental health parity. Just as some background, we for a long time have had state law that has a requirement for coverage for mental health and does have a parity provision. There's also been a federal law on the books, which was fairly recently amended. And what we're attempting to do with this particular set of rules is not change our state law, continue our state law in place, but to overlay the federal requirements on that. So we just minimally complying with the federal law in these rules. Just so you understand maybe more clearly what we're dealing with here, the state law is quite a bit broader in that it applies to all kinds of types of health insurance coverage from individual and small group and large group, whereas the federal law just deals with large group. Our state law just deals with biologically based mental illnesses, but the federal law deals for large group for all types of mental illnesses. And the thrust of the federal law is parity. So what we're doing is just going for the large groups, adopting that parity standard, following the federal regulations pretty much to a T. I think it's almost verbatim from right out of the federal regulations when you look through these rules. And again, it's a parity situation so that if a large employer is going to cover mental health benefits, that they need to do so on the same basis that they do for other covered illnesses. And then the last section deals with health insurance as well, and that's the under 19 market. Last fall, when we put forth our rules to incorporate those federal requirements out of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that went into effect on September 23rd of 2010, there was a requirement for open enrollment for those under 19 without regard to their health status. The insurers at the time were concerned about getting a disproportionate share of high-risk individuals through this open enrollment process. The rules at the time did have a provision for disproportionate share, but did not define how we determined disproportionate share. We promised last fall that we would go work with them and try and come up with a more specifics on how we would arrive at a disproportionate share determination, and that's exactly what these rules do, is lay out the process for how we determine an individual carrier has received a disproportionate share of high-risk individuals. You see there's two different ways they can qualify. One is that the earned premium associated with such individuals as a percentage of their overall business, individual business, is higher than the average. Actually, we did 5% as a threshold. And then secondarily, if they're claims associated with such individuals were higher than the other carriers on a relative basis, exceeded by 10% margin. And then we clarified a couple of things, probably the most significant of which is that they will not be able to decline a person under age 19 because they already have Medicaid or are on the CHIP program. Those individuals could still opt for open enrollment. That is the package in a nutshell, and I will stand by for questions. Thank you.
Are there questions of the committee for Mr. Moses? I have one quick question, if no one else does. A couple of them, actually. With regard to the mental health parity, can you explain what you mean by, or what the rules imply by biologically based mental health versus other kinds of issues that one might have and what might be covered and what might not be?
Certainly. The biologically based is in statute, and I don't have that in front of me, but if I remember correctly, those are such things as manic depression, major depression, and schizophrenia, and a few of those other major psychotic disorders. They are listed out in that statute, wouldn't cover some of the more milder forms of mental illness.
Okay. And with regard to the disproportionate share section of the rules, what happens when a carrier meets that threshold?
The carrier, if they wanted to say that, that the threshold is met, we would allow them to opt out of the children's health insurance market. They wouldn't be able to continue selling anymore. If they wanted to quit selling, they'd have to quit selling to all kids, not just to unhealthy kids. So they'd have to quit selling to both healthy and unhealthy if that's what they wanted. So that's their choice. If they hit disproportionate share, is to request that we make that determination, then they would exit that market.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hunt.
Thank you. Mr. Mose, two areas I'd like to talk about. On page 1 and on page 7, you refer to unless coverage is direct marketed, the agent must ask and respond to the questions on the form, et cetera. And you said that the form is needed and those answers are needed to help protect the individual purchasing the insurance, and you gave as one reason preventing duplicate coverage, I believe, et cetera. So what's the protection in the direct marketing area for that same concern or those concerns? What do we have in rules, or what's the protection to make sure that our people that are getting these things in the mail and filling them out and sending them back are getting the same protection that the other system where the agent is going to the house and talking to him? Can you just comment on that?
Certainly, I'd be glad to. There is one other backstop in our regulations, and that deals with on the insurance company side. And in the insurance company side, there are some standards that they must adopt. And one of those is to ensure that duplication of policies is not occurring. And since they're the ones that are receiving the applications, and if in fact they get incomplete applications and that is not something that they're following up on, then they're potentially in violation themselves. So that is a little bit of a backstop for them. It doesn't specifically say you can't accept an application if it's not filled out, but they have a general obligation to ensure that duplication doesn't occur.
Follow-up? Madam Chair.
Representative.
Is the department, well, let's put it this way, are there any other states that have some rules that basically deal with that? And one of the things I'm thinking about is I have a number of elderly clients, and they're getting swamped with stuff in the mail all the time. And they're duplicating a lot of times. Magazines is probably the best example. I've had one that had a subscription out to 2030, in fact. But when it comes to all of the mail that they're getting, the elderly people and whatnot, are there any other states out there that have adopted some rules that we could piggyback on that would help our people and protect our people from the direct marketing?
Representative Hunt, I'm not aware of any states that have gone beyond what South Dakota's already done on direct marketing. I think we've taken some steps on that. One of the ways we've tried to alleviate that's not addressed in these rules deals with what's called lead cards, because that's how they usually try and sneak around these. We're sending are you interested in some Medicare information on Medicare changes? Well, what happens is then you're solicited, or they get something in the mail. And we do have some standards in place for trying to deal with those that are probably ahead of most other states. But as far as a program to directly to pinpoint and reduce the number of solicitations you receive in the mail, no, I'm not aware of any state that's doing that at this point in time.
Madam Chair, just one other question, and that's on page 45. On page 45, there's a rule entitled length of disproportionate share approval, and there's a requirement that states once a health carrier no longer meets the disproportionate share threshold, that carrier must notify the director as such. Is there a need for any sanctions to ensure that that's done?
In my opinion, no, there's not, because if they fail to do so, then they have to continue to market to those individuals, and they're only out of the market if they want to apply to us and get disproportionate share. So we would not consider it a problem if a company wanted to voluntarily stay in the market.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Torno.
Thank you. Mr. Moses, looking at Rule 20-0640-70, page 35, I was a little bit curious about the exemptions for small employers, and it talks about defining a small employer
as employing at least one, but not more than 50 employees on business days during the preceding calendar year. On any business day, on the average, I'm thinking about those that might hire 52 or go to 48.
Representative Torno, I know that language, and I remember it came right out of HIPAA, because that's how you determine whether the small employer is on a HIPAA, but I can't remember the specifically how they do that. I believe there's some federal guidance on how to exactly determine that, but I just don't recall off the top of my head.
Just to follow up.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm almost wondering if it isn't supposed to be on the average business days, because in the next rule, 71, it talks about is determined based on the average number of employees the employer reasonably expects to employ on business days during the calendar year. If you know, I'm just kind of curious.
Like I said, I know there were some specifics on that, and I'm sorry, I'm just not recalling those.
Other questions for Mr. Moses?
Madam Chair?
Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Moses, once these statements are filled out regarding Medicare supplement policies, et cetera, are they required to send them to you as Director of Insurance so that you have them on record, or how do you follow up on whether the insurance companies are actually filling out the statements that they need to fill out and that there isn't duplicity?
Thank you. No, they're not all applications are filed with our office. We do have some mechanisms for tracking. Certainly, we have the ability to do examinations of insurance companies or investigations if there's a complaint or something. We also require reports on duplication of Medicare supplement insurance, and if we detected a problem in the reports as far as a level of activity there, that would be another trigger that we could use to look into it further and request copies of applications and see if a company was or an agent was appropriately filling out these applications. But as far as getting them routinely, no, we do not.
Okay. Then follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So do you find that there's a lot of duplicity with long-term care policies in the state?
There has been some. Certainly that has been a problem in prior years. I think similar to Medicare supplement insurance, with the measures that we've taken over the last 10 years, we've made some significant strides in reducing that problem. But I will not tell you it's eliminated completely. No, it is not.
So follow up again, Madam Chair.
Representative Gibson.
So if there is duplicity, say, with a long-term care insurance policy, then who pays, or do they both pay?
If in fact there is a duplication of a long-term care insurance and two coverages are applicable to the same stay, yes, they would end up sharing the cost of the stay up to the appropriate amounts in the policy. So it could be that both policies are paying less than they would ordinarily do just because a person has two policies instead of one. But there are some instances where you may want to have two long-term care policies. It's a little bit different than Medicare supplement. For instance, if you had purchased an older policy and maybe you had only a $50 a day benefit and you bought another one later on just to add to it because the cost of long-term care has certainly gone up over the years, that may well be a totally appropriate purchase and not a situation where you're talking over insurance. So long-term care insurance is a little bit different than Medicare supplement in that regard.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
So then, Mr. Moses, both companies would be required to pay, say it was a $50 a day charge, and that was your policy, so then in essence the purchaser would be able to collect $100 a day, 50 from each company.
Assuming that that's what the total long-term care costs, yes, that's
okay.
Very well what could happen.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Moses.
Thank you.
Are there other proponents here to speak on the behalf of these rules?
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senator Buell, members of the committee. My name is Terry Dosh. I serve as the Executive Director for the South Dakota Council of Mental Health Centers, also as Executive Director for the South Dakota Council of Substance Abuse Directors. My comments pertain specifically to sections 42 through 74 of the rules that you're considering today. These are the portions of the rules that implement the provisions of the Wellstone-Dominici Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008. That federal law passed in 2008, was implemented, and was effective in July 2010. These rules are necessary to put those measures into place. From inception, I asked Mr. Moses and Mr. Anderson if we could be part of the process to put these rules into effect. We were concerned about preserving the mental health parity statutes that are already in effect in South Dakota, as passed in 1998 and modified in 1999. I would just remark to you today and make you aware that we were fully a part of the process. I think we were accorded ample opportunity for input, and our input was considered. Besides my associations, I would just advise you that the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, the Divisions of Mental Health, Divisions of Alcohol and Drug Abuse were also participants in that forum. I don't represent them here today, but just to make you aware that the behavioral health field did play a part in this. We support the rules as they're proposed to you today.
Thank you. Are there questions for this presenter? Thank you. Are there other proponents? Any other proponents? All right. Are there opponents of the proposed rules? Any opponents? All right. I guess with that, we will close for public testimony unless there are other questions of the committee. All right. We can go ahead and move to committee discussion and or action.
Move to approve.
Second.
All right, we have motion for approval from Representative Torno, second by Representative Gibson. Discussion on that motion.
Just very briefly, I think these are a good set of rules, and I think the case was made for them, and I think they should be supported.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion on the floor is for due pass. Secretary will please call the roll.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Torno?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Buell?
Aye.
Motion carried.
All right, motion carries.
Thank you.
With that, we will move on to the next agenda item, which is proposed rules from the South Dakota Lottery Commission. Good morning,
Madam Chair, members.
Norm Lingle. I'm sorry. Norm Lingle, Executive Director of the South Dakota Lottery. The rule amendments before you were approved by the Lottery Commission at their March 25th meeting. The amendments to the rules do basically three things. They update the rules to align with advancement in technology. They put in rule procedures currently used by the lottery. And they provide licensed manufacturers with options and flexibility in designing the games. And with that, I'd like to step through each of the rule amendments that we have, beginning on page 2. What this amendment does is it allows the lottery to collect the new machine license fee during the billing period in which the machine becomes active, rather than once a month during the billing period that ends on the 15th. The lottery currently collects, does their sweeps of video lottery twice a month. The billing period is the 1st through the 15th, and then the 16th through the end of the month. Page 5 is the next amendment on sub 13. This amendment allows for communications with the machines to be conducted by means other than a telephone line. Currently, we do all of our polling of the machines via telephone. However, we know that through advancements that there are some lotteries with video lottery programs that communicate via satellite or wireless. And so what this would do is allow us some flexibility to choose the communication method, which would be the most cost effective. Page 6, it's basically the same thing. We're deleting telephone and inserting communication. Page 9. What these amendments do is identify audit information that must be retained and allows for this information, including a duplicate of the ticket, to be kept in either a paper or electronic format. Currently, all of our video lottery machines use what is called an impact printer. It would be similar to what you may see on some of the credit card type receipts where it comes out in duplicate. You have a white copy and a yellow copy. With these impact printers in our current machines, the yellow copy stays with the machine. Impact printers are becoming obsolete, and so this opens the door and allows for manufacturers to move towards what is called a thermal printer. Also on page 9, 48020606, this amendment here basically provides flexibility to the lottery as far as issuing the billing statements. As the rule currently states, we need to provide those by mail. However, with the advancement in technology, there are other options, and we've actually had some requests from some of our machine owners to receive this information electronically. A couple ways we could do that is through perhaps a secure website or an email. This is something that we would like to pursue here down the line. Page 10. This amendment clarifies the procedures by which electronic accounting meters may be cleared by either the manufacturer or a Type 2 technician after notifying the lottery. The gist of this amendment is that, as it currently states, we have to have a lottery employee on site, and frankly, we just don't have the employees to be out on site when a logic board or such is being changed on the machines. Page 11, we're looking at deleting must and inserting may be required. As you can see, there are a number of items listed here that a manufacturer currently must provide to the lottery, and frankly, it's at a point where a lot of that information we get, we have to find a place to keep it, and we seldom refer back to it. And so what this does is allows the lottery some discretion on whether to require that information or not. Okay, page 14. This amendment here would allow video lottery machines to maintain copies of tickets in either a paper format within the machine or in an electronic format on either a self-contained internal or external medium. As I had mentioned earlier, we currently have impact printers. The standard is kind of moving to a thermal printer, and so we need to come up with a way to retain that audit information, and this is the way that we're proposing to do that. One item I'd like to point out is we made a grammatical change in the original rules that were approved by the commission. We had used the word median, and it should be medium. And so we've made that change on the copies that you folks have. We feel this is not a substantial change in the rules, and so we made that rule or that wording change after consulting with Mr. Decker. OK, Okay, on page 15 and then carrying over to page 16, Rule 48.020802, this is the software requirements for randomness testing. What we did here is clarified that if a symbol is used in a video lottery game, that it must undergo the randomness testing. A symbol was listed and used in Rule 48.020809 software requirements for lineup games, and so we wanted to clarify and make clear that if you do use a symbol, that it undergoes, it will have to undergo the randomness tests. Page 17. This is very similar to an amendment I talked about earlier. Basically, it clarifies the procedures by which electronic accounting meters may be cleared by either the manufacturer or a Type 2 technician after notifying the lottery. Page 18 and carrying over to page 19. These amendments really do three things. It clarifies that it's optional for a game to offer the player to the chance to select numbers or symbols. It requires that all lines are clearly identified when playing additional lines brought into play by wagering additional credits, and allows other specified shapes to be a winning combination other than a vertical, horizontal, or diagonal line. Page 20. We added a sub 9, the hard meter readings of a machine. This information is needed, and we currently request it, and it's important for when we do machine reconciliations. Page 21. Basically the same thing. We added a sub 9, the hard meter readings of a machine. Once again, that's information needed when we do a machine reconciliation. Page 22. We are proposing to delete Rule 48.02.10.05.01. The reason for the deletion is that the time frame for complying has passed, and this rule is no longer needed. The requirements for Type 1 and Type 2 technician are covered in Rule 48.02.10.05. And then the last amendment is on page 23. This amendment would do is require that software access points on each of the video lottery machines be sealed by security tape. And this is another advancement in technology. When video lottery first started, a lot of the critical information was being used on what is called an EEPROM. As technology has advanced, machine upgrades and such are being done by a thumb drive or a flash drive, and so they have these access points. This rule would state that we would put security tape over those access points, and so then when our friends in the Department of Public Safety are out inspecting the machines, they can look at that, see if that tape has been broken, and then refer back to the logbook to as to the reason as to why that security tape was broken. That's a an explanation of the rule amendments that are before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have at this point.
Are there questions for Mr. Lingle? Senator Hanoff.
Thank you. I just have one, and that was at the beginning when you were going through about instead of shall to change may for reporting that information that you're collecting data that you don't do anything with it because it's too, I mean, why did you even leave it in there? Who's going to do it if you don't have to do it mandatorily?
You know, I guess the question is there may be a time where we do need to refer back to the schematics of a machine or some of those things, and so this would provide us that opportunity to go back and request that information of the machine manufacturer.
Senator Valley.
Just a couple questions on the integrity of the machines. First of all, could you tell me what a Type 1 and Type 2 technician are and who they are employed by, who they're responsible to? And then we also talked about the ability to clear the machine and who a Type 2 technician could do that, and so that's going to get back to my integrity of the machine. And the other one that is, it talks about integrity of the process is thermal paper. Doesn't that fade over time? I mean, unless they've got new technology. I've got old receipts that I went to look at and they're gone. I mean, you know, it just melted away into thin air. So those are my questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Valley, if I could answer your last question first. Thermal printers are improving as we speak. The thing that with the video lottery program that helps us out to address your specific situation is that those tickets need to be claimed the same business day. And so it should not have the exposure to excessive heat, sunlight, those things that would cause the ticket to fade.
Okay.
Your first question regarding Type 1 and Type 2 technicians, those folks are typically employed by the licensed operators. The operators are our machine owners. Each operator for every specific type of machine that they have within their inventory, they need to have a Type 1 or Type 2 technician. For example, if you have a Spilo machine, you need to be certified as a Type 1, Type 2 technician on the Spilo machine. If you have a VLC machine as well, you also need to be certified as a Type 1 and Type 2 technician on the VLC machine. What this is we work with the machine manufacturers, and they have to pass the technicians have to pass a specific test on that particular machine in order to become certified. A Type 1 technician, they do some of the more basic components and things regarding machine, changing paper, going in, turning on and off a machine, so on and so forth. Type 2 technicians, those are the folks that get in and do the board replacements and really get into the nuts and bolts of determining what is wrong with the machine, if there's something wrong with it, and trying to get it repaired and back up and running. Regarding the clearing of the meters, what is done on those logic boards is what is a term that's called a RAM set, where they basically go in and clear out the information on that logic board. Right now, the only folks that can do the clearing of those logic boards and the RAM setting of those logic boards are the manufacturers. So regarding the integrity, we also have rules within the video lottery program that an operator needs to maintain a supply of parts, replacement parts. And so if I have a main logic board bad on one of my machines, I will go to my my bench. I will find a main logic board for that particular machine. I will take that out. I will pull out the old corrupt logic board, insert the new one, call the lottery, have it enabled for gameplay, and then I will send the corrupted logic board back to the manufacturer for them to RAM set and clear it, and then it will come back to me and go onto the shelf as part of the inventory.
Senator Valley.
Follow up. I'm not totally technical savvy, and I don't understand the machine, so that's the basis for my questions. So in other words, when a machine is malfunctioning, a Type 2 technician can go in and work on the machine. And is that logged somewhere, and do they tell you at the at the commission, we're into machine number 4763, it's malfunctioning, I'm putting in a new board, and that's written somewhere in the Z, then, I mean, my concern is tampering with the logic board so that we make sure that we don't give out much winnings. And so I go in and put a logic board that gives me more logic.
I understand. What happens is that if a logic board needs to be replaced, they will call our office, and we will pull the machine. We will call up the machine and attempt to get the most current meters and also disable the machine. Sometimes we can get that far. Other times something is wrong that won't even allow us to do that. Okay, so they are notifying us. The other thing is if they put in a logic board, the machine will not become active until we the lottery call it through our central system to enable it. And so we do have those checks and balances. The other thing is that within each machine is a logbook. And every time a door is opened on that machine, the technician needs to write the date, time, and the purpose for opening the door and getting into the machine. And so the public safety inspectors, when they are out doing their inspection, they will look and see if the folks are keeping the logbooks up to date.
So when I open the door, it actually puts in a time and date when I did that, so that you have the say paper log that also matches something that's on a chip that registers when I get in that door, so that if I go in there to change the logic or do something, it will be known. And the second part of my question then is that information you can verify from the commission that if there's any tampering of a machine when you look at that logic board?
We can. We track, the machine tracks what are called events. A door opening is an event, and so it is tracking that on the machine. The other thing is that when you do open the door on a machine, an audit ticket will be kicked out of the printer at that point in time. And so what I have seen happen on some of the machines I've looked at is that audit ticket gets stuck right in with the logbook.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Mr. Engel, I'm looking at page 10, and this is a rule entitled Settlement of Accounts, and when you address this rule in your remarks, you indicated that you didn't have enough lottery employees to be able to have a person present. My question is this: why was the original rule? Why did the original rule require a lottery employee to be present?
My speculation. I can't speak to the original intent in 1989, but my speculation, Representative Hunt, is that at that time the lottery had its own inspectors, and then I believe it was in 95 when a lot of the inspection services were combined under the Department of Public Safety. We lost that ability, and the lotteries, when the lottery did employ its own inspectors, they were stationed throughout the state, and so when some of this needed to happen, they were there, and then they could go and actually be on site when that occurred.
And who are the inspectors now?
It's a group of folks through the Department of Public Safety.
Okay. Then, just to follow up, Madam Chair, you indicated that the Type 2 technician could be an employee of the operator. Does that give any rise for concern that the operator and the operator's employee is dealing with replacing the logic board without anybody other than the long-distance review that the commission has? Is there a concern that we may be opening ourselves up to a breach of security because now we've got potentially all the people involved, at least on site, being one business?
We have other checks and balances through our central system. I'm not sure I want to get into the full security explanation, but we have other checks and balances that when it pulls, it is it goes through a verification process to ensure that it is the proper logic board programmed to the proper level and such before our machine will enable it for gameplay.
So you don't feel there's any potential for a breach of security under this new rule?
I don't feel that it will be.
Madam Chair, one follow-up question. That's on page 16 when you're starting to talk about the symbols. And obviously that's going to get us into the slot machine dialogue here, I suspect, as we go along. But you mentioned, of course, the random testing. Can you describe what you mean by random testing?
What I can explain to you is, and to the best of my explanation, to my knowledge, is that, you know, sub 1 through sub 4 talks about the different types of randomness testing. Now, we have a contract with an independent third party called Gaming Labs International, really it's that is what we depend upon them to do because they're the experts. They have the mathematicians and the modeling and such. And so through the machine approval process, before it's finally approved for sale and placement in a video lottery establishment, it needs to be tested via Gaming Labs International and signed off by Gaming Labs International. In a nutshell, the lottery does what we call the communication testing. Gaming Labs does the randomness testing, the math testing, the payout percentage testing, so on and so forth.
Thank you, Mr. Lingle. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions from the committee of Mr. Lingle? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Lingle. Are there other proponents of the proposed rules?
Yes, good morning, Madam Chair. Bob Ryder, I'm an attorney in Pierre. I work with the South Dakota Music and Vending Association, and I'm appearing on their behalf this morning. Just briefly, we understand the need for these proposals. We appreciate the focus that the proposals bring to the issues that they discuss, and we support the efforts of the Lottery Commission in pursuing these proposals. Think they're well done and well positioned and appropriate. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee for Mr. Ryder? Thank you. Are there other proponents? Thank you. The chair would remind proponents to not duplicate testimony, as has already been encouraged.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Larry Mann, representative of Video Lottery Establishments. And I think my only comment would be that we recognize that technology changes fairly rapidly, and I think some of these rule changes are truly intended to just allow us to maintain that kind of technology improvements as the games go forward. So we urge your approval. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Mann? Are there other proponents? Any other proponents of the proposed rules? Are there opponents of the proposed rules? Any opponents? With that, we will. Are there any final questions from the committee? Seeing none, we will open for committee discussion and or action.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hanna.
Thank you. I move due approval on the proposed rule changes for video lottery.
Second.
Second.
Moved by Senator Hanoff, second by Representative Gibson, to approve the rules as proposed. Discussion on that motion.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. You know, I know there's been a lot of discussion regarding what this is going to do, as far as there's been certainly proponents out there, and there have been some opponents and some discussion about what the original intent was when video lottery went in and went in the statutes and how it's being interpreted. I think that, this is not a declaration, but we do know that we're dealing with declining revenues, and there certainly are implications, and certainly looking at opportunities on how we can sustain that if, in fact, we are going to go this direction for providing revenue for the state of South Dakota. I think that the proponents have provided a basis for that. There is support for it, and for that reason, I think that we it is within the consistency of the statute, and certainly creates and broadens an opportunity for players to have some access, and with that, I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Any other discussion from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have been provided with a great deal of information on this set of rules. We've been provided by some attorneys representing various groups in support and in opposition to these particular rules, and in large part, I think it's because there has been some question about whether or not these rules might be going beyond what the Constitution and our state laws provide relative to lottery games. I suspect that all of us on the committee have probably looked at these legal arguments, probably talked with other attorneys and whatnot, and while we don't have any sort of official legal opinion, I think we have done our homework. I'm satisfied, based upon the legal information that I've been provided, that these rules are in accordance with the Constitution, constitutional amendments that have been made regarding video lottery, and also with regards to the statutes implementing those. But I realize this is a question that some people may raise as more and more people become aware of these rules. But I just wanted to go on record to say that we have looked, at least I have looked, and I suspect all the members of the committee have looked at the legal ramifications of the adoption of these rules. I will be in support of these rules. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other discussion? Senator Valley.
Thank you. Well, I'm one of those that did go back and look and looked at a timeline and tried to determine. Our job here is, whether I agree with video lottery or not, is to make sure that the rules that are written are consistent with what was the intent of the law and the Constitution. And going back and looking at it, it's definitely my feeling that these rules do meet that criteria. And whether it's, you know, the argument made to me that we need to do this because it will enhance the revenue to the state, I think that's nice, but that's not the reason I'm voting for these rules. The reason I'm voting for the rules is, do these rules go beyond, or do they stay within what was the legislative intent and the intent of the constitutional provisions? And my take on it is that, yes, it does, and therefore I think we should pass these rules. Thank you.
Any other discussion? I'll just add that I would tend to agree that this is within the guidelines of what was originally passed in 1989, and I think that it makes sense for us to do our best to stay in line with advancing technology. So I will also be supporting. The motion on the floor is do pass. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed will vote nay. Secretary will please call the roll.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Torno.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Buell.
Aye.
Motion carried.
All right. Motion carries. Those are passed. I was just going to say that I think we'll take a 10-minute break before we jump into the next agenda item. So committee is in recess. Here you, Representative Gibson.
Okay.
All right. We will proceed to the next item on our agenda, which is proposed rules from the Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Nelson, Public Utilities Commissioner. I have with me today Commission Chairman Steve Kolbeck, Vice Chairman Gary Hansen, Commission Counsel Rolaine Wiest. All will be available to answer any questions that you might have. What I'd like to do today is really touch on three areas that I think were your areas of concern at the last meeting, and hopefully we can move through this. I want to touch on the scope of the rules. I want to touch on the process that we went through, and I want to touch on the decision that we actually made and how that was done. First, on the scope, I've got to stress the scope of these rules is really very limited. First of all, it applies only to intrastate long distance. If you're making a call from South Dakota to some other state, these rules do not apply. It's only intrastate. Secondly, it only applies to CLECs, competitive local exchange carriers. As you know, each area of the state is covered by an incumbent local exchange carrier that has the obligation to provide service to everybody within their incumbent territory. This does not apply to those. It applies to the CLECs that have chosen to go into business and chosen to go in and compete with an incumbent carrier. And thirdly, it only applies to the switched access part of the phone bill and the money transaction that's involved in those long-distance calls. The payment is made from the long-distance carrier to the local exchange carrier, both at the originating end and the terminating end of that call. And that's the piece that this is talking about, very, very limited in scope. Let me touch on process for a moment, and I'm going to spend a little bit of time here since I think this was your biggest area of concern. This has been a lengthy process beginning in 2005 as a rulemaking docket that really started out very broad, looking at a wide range of switched access charges in South Dakota. There were hundreds of pages of testimony that were submitted to the Public Utilities Commission since 2005. How do I know that? Well, when we went through our rules hearing, I asked, how do I, as a new commissioner, get up to speed on this? And they said, well, look at this, 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 and this, and I did, and oh my goodness. There were hundreds of pages of testimony that came in, and I can tell you that that testimony covered single rate, low rate, single rate, high rate, dual rates, all kinds of different configurations were given to us in that testimony. In May of 2009, the PUC released a draft set of rules for additional comment, trying to solidify the testimony that had come in. After that, we received more written testimony. That testimony led the PUC to again release another revised draft of rules, which they did in November of 2010. Following that, we held on January 20th the formal rules hearing, based on those rules that were released in November. At that rules hearing, we held and took oral testimony from all that came before the commission. We opened it up to further written testimony for those that wanted to submit that, and many did. We then publicly noticed and held a special commission meeting on March 18th. And the purpose of that meeting was to finalize the rules promulgation process on behalf of the commission and move these rules forward. At that point, the commission did finalize the rules, and I'll talk a little bit more about that process in a moment. And as you know, then, at the last Rules Review Committee meeting, you reverted those and asked us to receive additional testimony. We opened it up, and we did receive additional written testimony from a number of the parties. Then on April 19th, at the PUC's regular commission meeting, again, publicly noticed that we would be taking action on these rules, we opened it up for an opportunity for additional oral testimony on these rules. No oral testimony was given at that time. No one came forward to offer anything additional. And at that time, the commission readopted the same rules that we had brought forward several months ago. Let me finish by talking about the actual decision that was made and how we arrived at that. We were guided by SDCL 49-31-85, and that rule says in part, any regulation of telecommunications services by the commission pursuant to chapters 49-13 and 49-31 shall be fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory, and applicable to all telecommunication carriers providing service in the state. And then it goes on to give the commission the authority to promulgate rules to accomplish that. That was the guiding principle that we have. Now, I know at the Rules Review Committee several months ago, there was some discussion about big companies versus small companies. And I can tell you as a commission, based on that statute, we did not go down that road. We took the statutory obligation to create rules that are not discriminatory, and we didn't go down that big company versus small company road, but rather went down a road of treating all businesses that have chosen to be competitive exchange carriers to treat them equally. I want to talk just a moment about SDCL 1-26-4, which is the public input requirements for rules adoption. Subsection 5 of that says the agency shall afford all interested parties reasonable opportunity to submit amendments, data, opinions, or arguments at a public hearing held to adopt the rule. We have done that over the period of almost 6 years. Subsection 6 of that statute says the agency shall accept written comments and the hearing may be specifically continued for the purpose of taking additional comments. We have had copious quantities of written comments. And perhaps most importantly, if you could for a moment focus on subsection 7 of that statute with me. It says after the written comment period, the agency shall fully consider all amendments, data, opinions, or arguments regarding the proposed rule. A proposed rule may be modified or amended at this time to include or exclude matters which were described in the notice of hearing. And so at our March 18th meeting, your Public Utilities Commission, I believe, followed subsection 7 to the letter. We considered all of the testimony that has come in over the last 5 or 6 years on this matter. And at that March 18th meeting, our Commission Chairman Colbeck indicated how he believed the final rule ought to be written based on the testimony that was submitted. I concurred with his conclusion, again, based on the testimony submitted. At that meeting, we took oral testimony on that proposal and through a unanimous vote of the Commission, adopted the rules that you see before you today. And as you know, we determined that all CLECs would deal with the quest rate of 6 cents. That's what they would be paid for terminating and originating those calls. The majority of CLECs are already at that rate, but as you know, based on testimony before you, there are some that will see a reduction. But realize, these are competitive local exchange carriers that have chosen to go into primary quest areas. And in doing that, they are asking to be paid a higher rate than what Quest is paid. And we as a commission did not feel that that was appropriate and therefore chose to establish the Quest rate for all. Again, going back to 49-31-85 requires us to establish rules that are fair. And we as a commission believe that we have met that requirement in the rules that we've brought before you. We've adopted a rate that is fair and non-discriminatory. At this point, I would be happy to answer any questions that you have along with my counterparts. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? No questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there other proponents of the proposed rules? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Carman. I'm an employee of Quest, which is now a subsidiary of CenturyLink. We are in support of these rules. We believe that the process has been adhered to. We spent a lot of time going over this over the last 5 or 6 years. And through our testimony and the testimony of others, we believe it has all been given careful consideration, and we urge your support.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee for Mr. Carman? Thank you. Other proponents of the proposed rules? Good morning again.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Brett Kennecke for the entity known as Verizon Business Services. We appeared last time. We're still in support of these rules. I'm just essentially here to offer myself for any questions which you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? All right. Are there other proponents?
Madam Chair, my name is Talbot Wysorek. I'm with the law firm of Gunderson Palmer. I'm here today representing Sprint Communications. We also rise in support of the rules. One comment I'd like to make is that Sprint Communications actually advocated for the rules to go further, but we are supporting these rules as a good first step in trying to resolve some issues the state. Basis and would ask that they be approved. And I also would make myself available for any specific questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this presenter? Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there other proponents?
Madam Chair, Bill Van Camp. I'm an attorney from Peer representing AT&T, and we, along line with the other proponents, rise in support of these rules. We think they represent an important first step in the continued reform of access charges in the state of South Dakota. And with that, I'd be available for any questions.
Thank you. Are there other proponents?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Nelson, Director of Governmental Affairs for Mid-Continent Communications. We're in support of the rules as presented to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there additional proponents? Last call for proponents. Are there opponents of the proposed rules? Anyone to share comments? That's an opponent. All right. With that, we will close for public testimony. Are there other questions of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hunt.
I have a question for Commissioner Nelson. Commissioner Nelson, as you may or may not be aware of, the Rules Review Committee has become extremely sensitive to fiscal impact. We had some legislation in the last session that helped to clarify that for the Rules Review Committee. I noticed that in the materials that I received, there was a communication from the Northern Valley Communications Group, and they addressed the fact that this was going to be a financial burden to the extent that it would prevent them from updating their operation and so on and so forth. Would you comment on that position by Northern Valley to the extent of whether you feel that there is a serious fiscal impact on a small entity such as that?
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to address that. I think that the number that all of us would like to see is what's the exact dollar impact on each of those companies that oppose the adoption of these rules. But without us knowing the number of minutes of this type of service that they are terminating or originating, we don't have those, and we didn't see those figures in any of the submissions that were made. I would mention in the submissions, I believe, from Midstate and RC, they talked about a percentage decrease in their revenue. And certainly that concerns us. But we also understand that that's something that in a competitive environment, there are things that come along and their business is going to have to adjust to that new rate. But we do understand that there will be an impact.
Go ahead.
If there is that type of extreme greater cost and so on and so forth, these entities, though, these CLECs, would still have the opportunity to come before the commission and seek some sort of adjustment?
That is true. As part of these rules, we've specifically said that they can come to the commission with a cost study showing us exactly what their costs are for this particular part of their service if they choose to do that.
Thank you, Commissioner Nelson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions
Madam
of the
Chair?
Committee? Representative Gibson.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Nelson as well, Commissioner Nelson.
Yes.
What would the cost, just for the record, what would the cost of a study be to a feasibility study for cost? What would that cost a small company to present to you the decrease in revenue for the small providers?
I don't have the testimony right in front of me that was submitted, but my recollection is that the companies testified that it may be somewhere in the $35,000 to $40,000 range, but that if there were interveners opposing what they were attempting to do, it could double that particular cost. And of course, the follow-up question is, how does that compare to the decrease in revenue that they may be facing? And again, those are numbers that none of the companies provided to us.
Follow up, please.
Go ahead.
Then would it be feasible for a small company to do one of those studies or just give it up and go out of business?
Well, I think if you read the testimony that those companies submitted, they argued that it would be prohibitive for them to do those studies. But in the end, again, we don't have the numbers to compare what the cost of those studies would be compared to the revenue loss that they are facing. And without that second number, I can't sit here and make a judgment as to whether or not it would be excessive for them or not. I don't know. We just don't have that second number to compare.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions of the committee? All right, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
We will close for questions and open for committee discussion and or action. Senator Valley.
I move to pass. Second.
Motion by Senator Valley, second by Representative Torno. Do pass. Comments on the motion?
I don't think it needs a whole lot more discussion. We discussed it last time extensively. We sent it back to the PUC. They took another look at it. There was more testimony written that was given. There was no oral testimony given at the PUC meeting. And as I understand it, most of the protagonists were either there or online and had their opportunity to make their point to the PUC if there was one to be made. And the PUC has made their decision after going through an extensive amount of decision-making process and looking at the alternatives, and have come up with the rules that fall under the legislation or the law that's on the books. So I would I feel that it's important that we pass the rules as they are written. Thank you.
Any other discussion from the committee? All right, the motion on the floor is do pass. Those in favor will vote aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will please call the roll.
Gibson?
No.
Hunt?
Aye.
Torno?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Buell?
Aye.
Motion carried.
All right, motion carries. That, I will pass the gavel.
Since I am not physically present, Senator Hunhoff, would you just fill in for me since you can see people actually in the committee room?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Representative Gibson.
Thank you.
With that, we'll move to the Department of Social Services for Child Protection Services.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Laura Ringling, Department of Social Services. In summary, these rules are being updated to repeal provisions that are no longer relevant or necessary, update language and definitions, reflect changes made regarding the department's recommendation during the adoption process, to reflect the department is the only entity that approves subsidized adoptive placement, to provide that a child is eligible for subsidized adoption if the child is eligible for Social Security income disability benefits, to outline circumstances under which a subsidy may be suspended, to revise the composition of the permanency planning review team, to include child support in the list of funds available to finance a child's foster care, to revise the time frame in which dispositional hearings are held in state court and to outline requirements for dispositional hearings in tribal court, and to require that adoptive studies be updated on an annual basis. Prior to beginning the formal promulgation process, we did provide these rules to child placement agencies for comment, and we did not receive any comments from those agencies. The hearing on these rules was held on March 22nd, and we received no formal comments on the proposed rules at the hearing or in writing after the hearing. With that, I would stand by for any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions? I do have one. When you say you submitted these rules and didn't get anything back, do you also contact tribal services and that for if there's any implication there, and did you get any feedback from those groups?
Thank you for that question, Senator Hunhoff. For that, I would have to ask Division Director Virginia Weisler.
Good morning. Virginia Weisler, Division Director for Child Protection. Senator Hunhoff, I did send these to LOWO, which is the Pine Ridge Agency, and to Standing Rock, and to Sisseton, Wahpeton, and Flandreau, because they are the agencies that we have agreements with.
And you didn't get any response
no
from them?
Comments, no comments.
Okay. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that's everything. Representative Torno?
Thank you. I have a question. I'm a little confused. Why the repeal of 140109? I mean, I read the reason. It says the department no longer counts an emancipated child's income to determine eligibility for alternative care. Why would you not consider that income?
Getting there. Do you have any?
Page 5, okay. I think, of your rules.
Well, Representative Turnow, the eligibility for child protection for this child under the age of 18, it's not based on income. So the eligibility for this child to be involved with our program began when there was a finding of abuse and neglect in his family.
Well, as a follow-up, so there was a finding of abuse and neglect at the age of 16. The child became emancipated at 17. Are you still providing services then at 17?
Representative Turnow, if the young man was emancipated at the age of 17, the department would no longer be involved.
Right, because of the emancipation, right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would somebody from the Department of Social Services, I don't know who is there, comment on the fiscal note and the cost decreases, it looks like, and just explain the cost decreases?
Representative Gibson, I think you're referring to the cost decreases with the collection of money from families whose children are in the foster care system, and I think we're talking about $4,400.
Right.
And that is the amount. The department has never been very successful in collecting any type of fee back from a parent whose child is in the foster care system. For one thing, the majority of our parents are, they can be on TANF, they have SSI, they're low income, and they're working with us in a number of other ways in terms of trying to maintain their house, maintain their job, maintain everything that they're doing and working with us to get their child back. And the amount of time and effort put in by the Office of Recoveries to recoup this $4,000 in discussions with the department secretary going through this rules process is that their time in recoveries could be spent much better working towards other recruitment of fees within the department.
Thank you.
Senator Valley, did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. As I went through these, I'm looking at my notes, and one, I see that there's a lot of duplicative rules, and I wonder how they occur. But more importantly, and it kind of goes to Senator Hunhoff's question, is who did you notify? I'm looking at who else do you notify? I'm trying to decide who would be on the other side of these rules? Who would be overlooking you saying, doggone, what are they doing here? And who would those folks be, and how do you, I mean, how do you make sure that they are contacted? I mean, as anyone, we don't want to tell our people are going to be against us what we're doing, but that is your job here, and I just want to make sure, how do you, I mean, you put a notice in the Argus Leader or whatever newspaper, that isn't going to get to me. Who is on the other side that would be looking at these? And they're quite extensive here to read through these and would say, you know, I do have a problem with this. And how do you contact those people?
Senator Valley, for example, the rules that deal with adoption, the people that we work with, our private child placement agencies like Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Family, Catholic Social Services, Children's Home Society also does adoptions. And so, like, for example, with LSS, the email conversation would go to Betty Oldenkamp, who is their CEO, and Sheila Weber, who is over Children's Services, which includes foster care and adoption for Lutheran Social Services. Bill Colson is the CEO for Children's Home Society, and his staff, Steve Deming in Rapid City and Roxy Schmidt in Sioux Falls, oversee the foster care and adoption program. And then we also work with those agencies, like I said, Catholic Family and Catholic Social Services, and we also contacted them. Even like Bethany Christian Services, Renee Engelbrentson from Rapid City, she would have also been contacted to review the rules that deal with adoption and if they also provide foster care to look at the foster care child welfare piece. And then I have my contacts with the tribal agencies if you'd like to know who those were.
That's fine. I just wanted to get a good feeling that we're reaching out, because sometimes that's my problem with some of the rules, that I'm wondering if the people that, you know, are affected by it are aware of what's happening. And so that works. Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have one more.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 6714-09, developmental disabilities, is repealed under Child Protection Services. Was that moved to another agency? Is that why it was repealed?
Representative Gibson, could you repeat that rule number?
6714-09. It's on page, the cover page one, after the rules explanations.
That was repealed. When was that repealed?
Representative Gibson, do you have a page number for that in the rules?
One.
One.
Okay. On Article 6714, it's 6714-09, where it says Child Protection Services and then Developmental Disabilities repealed.
Representative Gibson, that chapter was a chapter that has been repealed previously and is not part of this chapter. I can get back to you on the date that that chapter was repealed.
Okay. And has it been moved to another department is my concern.
We would also have to check on that as well.
Okay, because it's under Child Protection Services and somebody with developmental disabilities, I would think would still be protected, but perhaps move to a different department. If you could get back to me on that, that would be helpful.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Are there any other proponents? Are there any opponents? I see no opponents, so I will close this hearing to public testimony and open it up for discussion and or action by the committee.
Madam Chair, move approval.
Second.
It's been moved by Representative Hunt, seconded by Senator Buell to move the rule changes as proposed by the Department of Social Services. Any comments on that motion?
No, I think they've been well presented. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, there is a motion to approve the rules. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Buell.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Torino.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Motion carried. Thank you. With that, I will pass the gavel over to Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will a representative from the Department of Labor present the next rules, please? Labor and Regulations, South Dakota Retirement System.
Good morning. Good morning. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Wade Hubbard. I'm General Counsel to the South Dakota Retirement System, and I'm here to present their rules today. Initially, let me say that there are only 8 rule changes today. All of them are new rules. We haven't amended any rules this time, nor have we repealed any rules. That said, Mr. Chairman, with some later exception, none of them really relate to each other. So while I could just go through and present them all one after another, I would certainly, with the chair's permission, accept questions as we go along.
Why don't you give us a quick overview of each rule, and then we'll come back and take questions as a whole, if there are any.
Go ahead, Mr. Representative. Certainly, Representative Hunt. The first rule appears on page 2. It deals with redeposits in the South Dakota retirement system. Redeposits have been on the books forever. It's a way of giving a member a second shot. If a member terminates employment and chooses to refund the member's accumulated contributions, they sever their relationship with the system. If the individual returns, and let's say they felt that they had to refund under the circumstances of their termination at the time, or they just wanted to, and they come back and say, gosh, that was a pretty bad mistake, we allow them to redeposit that refund with interest at the actuarially assumed rate of return for the member trust. For example, that is 7.75% right now. If an individual comes back, they will pay interest to 7.75% on the refunded accumulated contributions, and therefore, at least actuarially, the trust fund is made whole. Actually, looking over the past few years, it would be a profit-making thing for the trust fund. that's well and good, and I think you understand the intent of this. So let me give you my own example. When I left the LRC in 1985 for a position in Rapid City, out of financial necessity, at least in part, I refunded. The money I didn't need, I fortunately rolled into an IRA. I came back to state employment a couple of years later. At that time, the redeposit statute said that a person could redeposit in their second year back. frankly, in my second year back, I couldn't afford it. And that was just the way life was. I missed my window. I eventually purchased all of that. And even at the old bargain rates, it cost me a lot more than redepositing. But that's the way things were intended, and that's how it worked. However, you've all heard me say before that with 73,000 members, you get a lot of different ideas, a lot of different circumstances. And we've had a lot of questions come back up on what does it mean to re-enter the system for purposes of SDCL 3-12-80. We didn't have any laws on the books. And frankly, there have been circumstances where we thought that members were kind of gaming the system. For example, work for a while, terminate, refund, return, do not make a redeposit, then terminate again, come back a third time and say, well, I'd like to redeposit the first refund, but not the second, or vice versa. Perhaps the second termination was a weekend, quit on Friday, start on Monday, just to start the two-year period again to redeposit. And it raises a lot of questions, a lot of issues of fairness among members. And finally, we thought that we ought to have a rule. Particularly, our benefits section came to me and said, we ought to have some rules saying what is a reentry for purposes of the statute. And that's what you have here on page 2 with 6201.02.11. It says that from now on, there are three conditions for redeposit. The member has to have either terminated employment or, pursuant to statute, dropped down to part-time employment where the individual no longer participates actively in the system and is then eligible for a refund. Second, the person has to have refunded. And finally, when the person comes back and they want to redeposit, it is only for the initial return after a refund that they can redeposit that particular refund. If there is a previous refund before that, not anymore. It has to be the initial return to active status after the termination or the shift to part-time service. And that's pretty much the first rule. The second one's on page 3. That has to do with privatization of units. There was quite a bit of this a few years ago, mostly with university cafeterias and so forth. And that's where a public entity or a portion of a public entity would be sold to a private sector. Again, cafeterias are a good example. That would mean that the employees, through no fault of their own, could no longer actively participate in SDRS, and that just didn't seem fair. They didn't terminate employment. They just got moved along from the public sector to the private sector. Recognizing that that was somewhat unfair, but realizing that we couldn't continue to give these folks credit for public service towards retirement, SDRS put together a program where this, I call it full service or false service, counts as far as vesting or towards, say, the rule of 85 for an unreduced retirement benefit. Again, it is not credited service towards retirement, but it, let's say a person had been working for 2 years and this happened. They worked for another couple of years. Those years would be enough to get the person over the three-year hurdle for vesting so that they would have some sort of retirement benefit for at least those 2 years. Not much, admittedly, but something. When we did this, we handled the problem that was there at the time, but nobody thought too much about the future. You know, what are we going to do with these folks down the line when it's time for them to do something with this service? This recently came up. Some years back, there was a portion, one entity, within the University of South Dakota Medical School that was privatized. An individual, a professional, well-salaried individual, that was there has stayed all these years and now is old enough to seek a retirement benefit. The person wasn't trying to game the system. He just came in with questions and he says, what do we do with me? First off, I want to start an SDRS benefit. Do I have to terminate my current employment to do that as though I were still in SDRS on active status? And, of course, the answer was no, that would be foolish to make them do that. But we didn't have anything on the books for that. And then other questions started to come up. This rule is here to answer those questions. For example, you see that the individual does not need to terminate the private employment, to start a retirement benefit with SDRS based on that previous public service. Secondly, if the individual terminates employment voluntarily, that stops this SDRS full service, if you will. And if the individual comes back to that private sector employment, the full service does not start up again. It is gone for good because now that's been voluntary. There is nothing unfair if the individual terminated of their own accord and then came back. That's really what this rule does. The third one deals with, again, a member's ability to change his or her mind. Several years ago, we brought you a rule that said that if an individual retired, started benefits, and received 0 or 1 monthly benefit, and then changed his or her mind, said, I would rather refund from the system, that was permissible. But if there's no more than one benefit, this new rule, again, deals with a member's change of mind. But here we're not talking about refunding. We're talking about changing the type of benefit. Most members have or take a standard formula retirement benefit. However, we have always had and continue to have an option for a member who retires prior to age 62, and that's not eligible for Social Security, but they want some kind of reasonable income, to take what we call the level income benefit. And there, we would give the member an additional benefit until they turn 62, and then the SDRS benefit drops off, and but remains in an amount that with the individual's Social Security is pretty much what they were getting before. It helps folks out, particularly when you see law enforcement officers, firefighters, and so forth, who have a normal retirement age of 55, way ahead of Social Security age. This rule allows an individual, again, so long as there's been no more than just one monthly payment, to switch their benefit delivery. They can say, boy, I was drawing normal retirement benefits and I can't make it. Could I please have a level income? Or is vice versa. They decide the level income isn't the best idea, and they want to change back. It also has a provision saying that if the individual is switching from level income to a regular benefit, that's a decrease. That means there's an overpayment if they did take that 1 month allowable benefit. The overpayment will be made up immediately from their ongoing regular benefits. In some cases, it is mathematically possible to take more than one monthly benefit to make that repayment, and that also is covered in this rule. Going on page 5, 6201070902, is a bit of a personal embarrassment, if you will. You've heard me say before that I work hard to keep us in compliance with the Internal Revenue Service law that governs us. IRS law requires that we have on the books either statutes or rules that talk about a member's ability, if they refund, to roll that refund into various other retirement plans. We've had the rule on the book for a long time for a member's ex-spouse, and we've had it for a deceased member's beneficiaries and so forth. And suddenly one day I was looking for it and I discovered we'd never done it for just a member who refunds. So that rule is just a compliance thing. Also, 3-12-76.3 requires such a rule, and somehow we'd never done it. Going on, at the bottom of page 5, you see 6201.07.13. That deals with the what we call the spouse option. It's additional survivor protection. And by the way, back in 2010, you folks in the legislature agreed with SDRS that this program should be closed to new enrollees. Way back in 1974, when the system started and this program started, it was difficult to find the kind of insurance that fills in the gap. Let me explain that. If a, let's say a member is relatively young, has been with the system for several years, the member passes away. If there are children, then we're going to provide a family benefit until the youngest child turns 19. If there are no children, there's no benefit provided until the surviving spouse reaches age 65, and then we'll pay a benefit to that spouse. In the case with the children, if the youngest one turns 19, then there's still a gap until that surviving spouse reaches age 65. This is insurance to fill that gap. Again, when the system started, that kind of insurance wasn't generally available. Now it is. Between that and the fact that the program has always lost money, you agreed with us to terminate it to new enrollments in 2010. However, we still have folks that are on the books or have been on the books that can create a problem. You have to watch this because it's insurance like a hawk for adverse selection. In other words, a person is in the program, they voluntarily get out, then they discover they're quite ill, and they come back and say, boy, I want to buy that insurance again for my spouse. Well, we're trying to avoid that. And you see a lot of it, well, not a lot of it, but I mean some of it, particularly after their breaks. And they may have terminated employment, and now they come back and say, whoops, better sign up for it this time, or whatever. Or go on administrative leave without contributions. They're inactive in the system at that point, and then come back. We've always treated breaks in service as the completion of the person's participation in the plan. And if they come back, they can't get back in, even though they were in before. But we've never had anything that outlines what constitutes a break that does not allow reentry to this program. That's what this rule does. It just sets out a list of options in coordination with 312.104 that establish when a member cannot return to the spouse option program. Finally, and mercifully, the last three are essentially three rules in one, put in three different programs. Again, we deal with the IRS on a regular basis. Congress had established a requirement that there be required distributions at a certain point. It's based on age. 72 and a half, essentially, or April 1st after the person, after the year of the person when the person turns 72 and a half, except not for public employees. They can keep working if they want, but the private sector have to start. You can see how complicated this gets. It's even more complicated on how much money must be taken out. And Congress and the IRS have both been pretty stringent about this because it was never intended as a matter of policy that an individual use these tax breaks for retirement to amass an estate for their beneficiaries. The point is to encourage people to use these tax breaks to save for retirement. And consequently, that's why you have the distribution requirements. The IRS distribution requirements can get so complex, not the ones in the code put out by Congress, but the ones that the IRS does through regulation, can get so complex that there are violations on a regular basis. And finally, even the IRS itself admitted in a revenue ruling some years back that distributions made under a good faith and a reasonable attempt to follow the Internal Revenue Code between 2003 and 2005 would be deemed okay, would be granted safe harbor, even though they violated the IRS regulations. Congress said, hey, that's a pretty good idea. Let's take it one step further. IRS, you will provide a rule saying not just from 2003 to 2005, but any attempt to follow our law in these is good enough, even if it violates yours. Our consultants, our actuaries, Buck Consultants, recommended that all of their public systems repeal their existing distribution laws and just put in a safe harbor law. We didn't go that far. We maintained our distribution rules, but we have gone ahead and taken Congress's invitation to adopt a fail-safe regulation. You see the one for the supplemental pension benefit on page 7. You see something that looks a lot like it on page 8. That's for the supplemental retirement plan. And finally, the last new rule on page 9 has virtually the same language for the special pay plan. They're just allowing us to duck and cover from the IRS when things get too complicated. And that's it. I hope I haven't spent too much time or made this too boring.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Any questions of Mr. Hubbard? Senator Buell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hubbard, going back to the page 5, Survivor Protection section, what was the basis for setting those criteria as what constitutes a leave? And was there a specific reason that other leave programs like Family Medical Leave Act weren't included?
This would be separate from FMLA, Senator. So that's why there was nothing included there. These are just the types of leave, including termination. And as you mentioned, administrative leave. Incidentally, I failed to mention that there's an exemption for military leave. We're not going to cut someone off if they get called up to, say, active service in the National Guard or whatnot, and then return. But it's virtually any break in service that's either by statute or voluntary, because if you don't do something about those breaks, people will come and go as they please, particularly when they especially need the coverage, and would then engage in adverse selection, which would make the program even more expensive than it is now for the members.
Follow-up, Senator?
I don't know if did that answer?
It does. I have one additional question, though, jumping back a little bit further. To the privatization of units, the first rule, does that apply to other folks who've been rolled over involuntarily, like the cement plant employees? And is any of that, I assume that's all just reactive based on circumstances that have arisen, and none of it's foreseeing into the future, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Senator Buell, this would apply to any privatization of any member unit or part of a member unit in SDRS, except the cement plant. It did not apply to the cement plant because they've had their own retirement plans.
Okay.
Any other questions, Mr. Hubbard? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hubbard. Are there any other proponents? Any proponents? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Any opponents? Again, seeing none, if there are any other questions by the members of the committee, if not, we'll move to committee discussion and or action on these retirement rules.
Mr. Chair, I move to pass.
Representative Gibson moves to pass approval of these rules. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Valley. Any comments, Representative Gibson?
Well, I think that these rules were well thought out, and I think they are complete and fill some voids and gaps and comply with federal regulations. So, therefore, I would hope that you join me in a do pass proposal.
Any other comments, members of the committee? If not, all those in favor of approving these rules will say aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will call the roll.
Buell.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Torino?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye. Rules are approved. I give the gavel to Senator Valley.
Thank you, Representative Hunt. We will now move to the Department of Agriculture, and we have rules on a new noxious weed we're going to put in, flowering rush. Would you please make your presentation? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Valley and members of the committee. My name is Darwin Kurtenbuck, and I'm the administrator for the Plant Protection Program for the South Dakota Department of Ag. I come before you today to request you to add flowering rush onto the local noxious weed list that each county may in the state have eight locally noxious weeds or pests on their local list, and we had a request from a county at the Weed and Pest Commission this past month in April to put flowering rush on this list. At this hearing, we had no proponents against it or for it. There was no comments of any sort. The commission approved to put this on. And what flowering rush really does, it's an invasive weed that's an aquatic weed, and it probably affects our low-lying lakes and river streams and things like that, where it'll push out the cattails and the other willows and bulrushes and things like that, which will impede recreational use, wildlife, and could affect irrigation ditches of some sort. With that, I'll be here for any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions? Just a quick one. You said you had one county that made this request. Does this make it statewide, though? That so if I've got flowering rush on, and I'm not the county hasn't taken a position or whatever, do I have to eradicate the flowering rush? How does that work? Could you explain that for us?
No, it doesn't. As I said earlier, each county can have eight locally declared noxious weeds or pests on their on this list, and that comes under 1262.07.03. And this is a list of, I think there's 19 weeds on it. Whenever a county makes this request and we just put that weed onto that list, which then would be in 1262.03.01.07. So, no, it's just what that county requests.
So if I'm a county and I already have eight and I want to add the flowering rush, I have to take one off. Would that be correct then?
That is correct. And this would stay on the list for 5 years. And in each county, if they put flowering rush on this year, 5 years down the road, they would have to make that request. Or they could probably make a request for something else and still have seven other ones on that list.
Thank you. Any other questions? Are there further proponents of this rule? Further proponents of this rule? There are no further proponents. We'll move to opponents. Are there any opponents of this rule? Opponents of this rule? No opponents of this rule. We will move to action and or discussion. We'll close it to public testimony and open it up to action and or comments by the committee.
Move approval.
Second.
It's been moved by Representative Hunt and seconded by Representative, was that Gibson?
Yes.
I thought I heard it over the phone.
You did.
Are there any comments on that motion?
I don't think anything unnecessary. Thank you, Senator.
If there are no comments on that motion, the Secretary will call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay.
Buell.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Torino.
Aye.
Hunhoff. Valley.
Aye.
Motion carried.
The rules have received a positive vote and will be approved as written. Now we'll move on to the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. And we have a fair amount of different licensing this time, especially in the area of
the elk licenses and a decrease in those. So with that, Mr. Leif, identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members of the Rules Committee. My name is Tony Leif. I'm Director of the Wildlife Division for the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. I'm here this morning to present to you the rules that were adopted by the Game, Fish, and Parks Commission at their April meeting in Brandon. There are a number of different rule changes, as Senator Valley had noted in this packet. Because of the way that the chapters are arranged and the rules are chronological, we tend to skip around a little bit, and I need to apologize for that in advance. I'll try to touch on a topic and note that we'll see that again later in some other rule changes. But in general, what you're going to see is a reduction in the number of elk licenses. It's probably the biggest thing that was of note that the commission took action on at their April meeting. And that is in response to a reduction in the elk population. That reduction in the elk population was no accident. It was a planned reduction by our agency in the attempt to get populations down at a level that was more commensurate with the needs of the private landowners out in the Black Hills. Elk can cause some damage to private stored feeds, and it was a management direction of ours a number of years ago to bring those elk populations down to a more tolerable level. And you'll see that reflected now in the license allocations that the commission adopted at their meeting. There are a couple other unrelated rule changes that I'll touch on that were relatively innocuous. The first of which is the first one that you'll note on page one of the rule changes, and that is the restrictions over firearms on lake access areas and game production areas. Subparagraph 8 on the Rawlings game production area, you will notice that the range that we had on that site had to be was previously only available for use if it was supervised, and that really inhibited the opportunities for use there, and you'll note there that the supervised restriction has been removed from that GPA. Next, the hunting license fees. There aren't actually a change. There are not any changes in license fees, but actually the type of license that you can get for deer hunting in Custer State Park has been changed to remove a couple. It used to be a two-tagged license. It's on the top of page 5. The whitetail license used to be a two-tagged license. Now would be a single any whitetail license under the rule change. And C, you'll note there, was previously that muzzleloader license was a two-tag license, and that, too, would go to a single-tag license. This, again, is in response to reducing the number of deer that are going to be harvested in Custer Park, and you'll notice that those there will be corresponding changes later on in the chapter that addresses those deer hunting seasons in the park. Next rule change on the bottom of page 7, you'll notice that the archery deer hunting season, the ending date for that season was adjusted by the commission to come back to January 15th rather than January 31st. This is one of those rules that you're going to see, again, a repeat of the same change later on here towards the end of the packet, pertaining also to the youth deer hunting season and the muzzleloader deer hunting season. The basis of the change in the closing date is primarily due to the fact that we have buck deer that are being harvested during this antlered season that no longer have their antlers. Of course, buck management is a pretty popular topic with our sporting public. Our deer hunters look forward to the opportunities to shoot bucks, and there is growing concern out there that we are harvesting an increasing number of these bucks after they have shed their antlers. And in particular, the larger bucks tend to shed their antlers earlier. So we are, in fact, having antlerless deer shot that are bucks that have shed their antlers, and, of course, removing that animal from the population and removing the opportunity to shoot that animal during our deer seasons when buck harvest is allowed. So once again, you are going to see that, again, that reduction in the season length later on in the packet. On to elk hunting seasons. The first one for your consideration this morning is the Black Hills elk hunting season. That starts on page 8. I won't go through the specific reduction in licenses, but you'll note through the throughout the rules where the strikeouts and underlines are that there is a general trend for a reduction in the number of licenses that are going to be issued for elk hunting in the Black Hills. The bulk of the reduction comes in cow tags or antlerless elk tags, but there are also some reductions in the any elk tags. In particular, on the eastern boundary units, the units that are along the eastern tier of the Black Hills, east of Custer Park and just south of Rapid City, that is an area that's almost all private land, and we have found fruits in our efforts to make a pretty good reduction in the number of elk there, to the extent that we are now also reducing the number of any elk licenses that would be issued for that. And those would be units H4 and H9 in your packet. I'll move on to the bottom of page 16, where we have a reduction in the number of any elk licenses that will be issued for Custer Park. Custer Park, like the rest of the Black Hills, has experienced a reduction in the elk population as our management direction dictated from the past few years. There would be a reduction basically in half of the number of licenses that are any elk licenses that are issued for the Custer State Park elk hunting season. Next is the Custer State Park archery elk hunting season. On the bottom of page 17, you'll notice that there's a reduction in the number of licenses, going from 5 down to 3 any elk licenses. Shifting gears a little bit, on page 18, the next chapter pertains to the Custer State Park deer hunting season. And you'll notice that the change there is that the number of licenses would be the same, but the type of license that would be issued in Custer Park would be a single tag license instead of a double tag license. So if there is a reduction in the total number of tags being issued, but not a reduction in the number of licenses. At the bottom of page 18 is the chapter that deals with the Black Hills archery elk hunting season, archery elk hunting outside of the Custer of Custer State Park. And again, you'll see the general trend within those changes within this chapter pertain to a reduction in the number of licenses that will be issued for the archery elk hunting season. That brings us to page 23. The bottom of 23 is the youth deer hunting season. You will see a reduction in the season length there. Again, previously explained during the archery deer hunting season that the youth deer hunting season would close on January 15th rather than January 31st as it has closed the last few years. And also on page 24, the muzzle loading season, you'll notice, will close on January 15th, similar fashion to archery and youth deer. You'll also note that in previous years, the muzzle loading deer hunting season has opened on the second Saturday of December, and the commission did adopt a rule change to open that season a little bit earlier, to the 1st of December. We used to run the East River deer hunting season later on into December, but last year the commission did reduce the length of that season also, and actually freed up some time and became aware of that this year, and thought that would be an opportunity to allow some additional hunting opportunity for those that hold or muzzle-loading deer licenses. Next, at the bottom of page 24 is the Custer State Park antlerless elk hunting season. Essentially, the action taken by the commission will close the antlerless elk hunting season in Custer Park. They've done this by way of leaving the rules in place for the chapter, just because there likely will come a day when there will be some sufficient elk populations to allow additional antlerless elk harvest. But at this point, essentially the commission zeroed out all of the licenses that would be available for that season. So there, in essence, would be no antlerless elk hunting season in the park this next year. Next, at the bottom of page 25 is a chapter that's entitled The Custer State Park Late Archery Elk Hunting Season. You'll notice a reduction in the number of licenses that would be issued there from 30 down to 15. The next elk hunting season begins on the bottom of page 26. It's the prairie elk hunting season. We do have a few units outside of the Black Hills, some on the periphery of the hills, and then a couple more that are over in eastern South Dakota, or not eastern, but east of the Black Hills, still in western South Dakota. The first of those is in north of the Black Hills, which is the unit that's entitled 09A. It's portions of Lawrence and Butte counties. You'll see a reduction in the number of licenses that would be issued for that unit. The next unit's in Bennett County. In addition to some adjustments with the license numbers, you will also notice that the commission took action to include a portion of Millette County in that unit. This is a private land unit. All the property in Bennett County and this portion in Millette County that would be added is private land, and the driving force behind our license allocation in these units is to reduce damage on crops that these elk cause. And on occasion, they have gotten up into this corner of Millette County, and it's been essentially a refuge for them in past years. And what we wanted to do was be able to provide those landowners with some relief, with these hunters being able to go up into Millette County should those elk move into that area in future years. You'll also note on subparagraph 5 in the Butte County unit that there were some adjustments in the season dates. This was in response to coordination with the landowners that own the property within this unit, that they wished to see this have a December season or a late elk hunting season in that area. So there was an addition of the addition of that month to the season in Butte County. Again, you'll see some additional reductions in elk hunting licenses in the Gregory unit. We don't issue a whole lot of licenses in that unit right now. We have a population of elk that we share with Nebraska, and Nebraska actually issues a comparable number of licenses in their state, too. One additional rule change that was adopted by the commission has to do with disability licenses, and that's on page 20. of your handout or your packet. Statute provides that the department can issue disabled hunter permits. In previous years, we had only issued those these permits to those individuals that had a physical disability. Became aware that we had the latitude to also issue these permits to those that individuals that have mental disabilities, but did not have the provisions in rule to do that. We'd actually been requested by a member of the public to address this issue because he had a daughter who was of an age where she was required to get a fishing license, and it was a somewhat difficult process for him because of the necessary requirements of getting the IDs and everything to get that license. And in fact, he had an occasion to take this disabled young girl's friend fishing, who was also of an age where they would need a full license, but basically decided not to take this gal along because of the encumbrance of trying to get that full license. It wasn't the fee necessarily that inhibited, it was the process necessary. So what the commission did was take action to establish a process by which individuals with mental disabilities could also get this reduced fee or near free 4-year license to allow them to go fishing. You will note that this license only allows those individuals to fish with this license. The latitude is for hunting and fishing, but we really didn't see an application where individuals with these severe mental disabilities to have a firearm and go field hunting. One notable rule that you do not see in this packet that attracted a great deal of attention was a proposed rule that would have restricted small game hunters to use non-toxic shot when hunting in road rights of way. It was a petition. The commission had received a petition from an individual in Bennett County who requested that the commission take action to prohibit the use of toxic shot in road rights of way. If you follow the newspapers at all, and if you took a look at the minutes from the meeting, you will have noticed that did solicit a great deal of public comment. Some in support, the majority of it against. In the end, the commission chose not to adopt that rule change, primarily because didn't feel that there was sufficient data, sufficient science to support the ban, and that it would have caused undue or unnecessary rules or cause for unnecessary rules to be put in place that would inhibit the ability of hunters to hunt in these road rights of way. That's what I have. I would be glad to answer any questions that any of you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Life. Questions by the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hunhoff had her hand up first. Sorry.
Thank you. I have a question. Just refresh my memory. On all these licenses that we've reduced numbers on, are out-of-state residents eligible for those licenses?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. The licenses that we're talking about here, there are no non-resident license allocations for elk hunting in the Black Hills. Demand is so high for those licenses in this state that the commission has never, and I'm pretty sure never is a correct term, never allocated any of those licenses for non-residents.
Senator Buell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the elk licenses in the Black Hills, you said that the herd reduction was intentional on behalf of the commission. Can you give me a history of what the license allocation has been in the past? And I assume this is just getting us back to where we've been, if you can provide some clarification.
It is. It was back in the early 2000s when we had received a lot of input from landowners in the Black Hills. Of particular note, you might all remember that we were in the midst of a drought. And in the midst of a drought, ranchers tend to covet their feed much more closely than they do when abundant rain. They always have concerns over elk depredation, but it was during that period of drought that we actually had a lot of public input that came in desiring a reduction in the number of licenses, a reduction in the number of elk, and corresponding to get to that goal, we needed to up the number of licenses. Just to give you a little bit of perspective, in 2006, we had just short of 2,500 elk hunters in the Black Hills. And this year, we are issuing a total of 865 licenses. So you can see that's a pretty substantial reduction. I think we're actually below where we were prior to year 2006. I don't have data in front of me to get that. We were probably issuing more on the order of 1,400 licenses. So we're not only looking to curtail the decline in elk numbers in the Black Hills, we're looking to build them back a little bit, not to the level that we were 5 years ago, but we are looking to build those herds somewhat.
Thank you.
In continuation of that, and I think you've answered my question, did we see the
deer population go down? You wanted to reduce it, but did it get further depleted than you desired? And is that just from hunting, or do you, I mean, I don't want to get too much into that, but I think you know where I'm going, and if you could comment on that, please.
A very good question, Mr. Chairman, and I probably was remiss in not noting that we did have another factor that is contributing to the both the population of elk and the population of deer in the Black Hills, and that is a new predator that we have on the scene out there in mountain lions. And mountain lions do take some of those animals out of the population and are a contributing factor to the reduction in the number of licenses that you see here before you. And you will also see that later on this summer when we get together and talk about the Black Hills deer hunting season too.
Further questions? Senator Hunha.
Oh, I'm back on my roll here. I did read the minutes, and I guess your comments regarding the youth season. Since you send out all those cards, what's the return or the kill that youth have? Because I guess I'm sort of, we want to get youth hunting, but we don't want them to have access to these bucks that somebody else wants. So what's the kill percentage rate on youth hunting?
I don't have those numbers in front of me here. We actually have some additional changes to the youth deer hunting season that the commission has under consideration right now. So I'm going to have to go off my best memory, and I think we issue on the order of 4,000 licenses and have about a 50% success. The season itself is very liberal, Senator Hunhoff. It starts in September, goes all the way through January 15th now rather than January 31st. And if you think about it, those 2 weeks, there's a valid argument to be made that that's a reduction in opportunity for those youth, but it's certainly not the best time of the year to be out deer hunting in those last 2 weeks of the season. And I think a strong argument could be made that there's a liberal season already when we start in September and go for 4 months essentially for that youth deer hunting season right now.
Just a follow-up. Liberal is right, but the concept is I don't want some youth to shoot a buck that I can get. To me, is not a rationale, and that it's back to the trophy. And so mm-hmm. I think, that's what's leading. It's not the liberal season. It's the concern that somebody's going to get the buck that doesn't have the horns, and I don't have it on my wall then showing. So let's, be honest. And that's what the minutes reflected also, the concern there.
Correct. That was the concern and the reason for the adjustment in the season. I maybe misunderstood your question there. I apologize if I did.
Further questions? We're going to get into the deer licenses next time. I'm just thinking in the hills. I see a lot of deer. Is the deer population down in the hills also?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. Actually, we are looking to, again, curtail a decline in the Black Hills deer population and actually looking to increase in numbers. A lot of individuals in the Black Hills see a lot of deer, and in particular in the urban areas. And that's not necessarily a reflection of what's going on off in the hills themselves, in the isolated tracks, and in particular the public land. As you all know, there's a lot of public land hunting in the Black Hills, and we have gotten sufficient harvests out in the more isolated areas of the Black Hills. The one exception to that is the northern Black Hills, where we are still looking for some reductions in our deer numbers in that portion of the hills that's up in the Sturgis Spearfish area.
Okay. Further questions? I'm afraid I do have to make a comment to you on the bloodshot. When I thought of that, when I'm hunting a lot of times, when we block, a lot of times people stand out on the road to block. And now they're going to have to make sure, I don't have any steel shot or whatever, and so I can't block on the road. Or I can just see a real problem, because that's a lot of times where you do. You get on the other side of the ditch to block, and you're not road hunting, but you are in the right of way. So I'm just going to throw that out as another thought process when your commission is discussing it.
Thank you. Yes, that issue did came up there too, so very valid concern.
Okay. Further questions? Are there any other proponents of these rules? Other proponents? If there are no further proponents, are there any opponents? Any opponents of the rules? Last time for opponents. If there are no opponents, we will close the public testimony and move to discussion and or action by the committee. Senator Buell.
I move to pass on the rules.
It's been moved by Senator Buell and seconded by Senator Hunt to do pass the rules as written. All those in favor? Any comments, Senator Buell?
Just to say that I think they're well presented. I actually am an archer, and so I am kind of wary of reducing the youth season that 2 weeks, but I think there's good reasons, so I would encourage support.
And you will probably be in the legislature then anyway, or at a what would I call it, a Cracker Barrel session on the Saturday, so from the 15th to the 31st. So, all right, any other comments? If there are none, Secretary will call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay.
Buell.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Torno.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Motion carried.
The rules are approved as written. We will move now to the Department of Transportation. And the Department of Transportation has a speed limit change. Would you introduce yourself and present the rule? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. Bill Nevin with the Department of Transportation. The Transportation Commission at their April meeting passed a speed zone rule in Gregory County. This rule amends Administrative Rule 7001-02-30, sub 4, on State Trunk Highway 47, beginning at the intersection with U.S. Highway 18 in the town of Gregory. This amendment would extend an existing 30-mile-an-hour speed zone an additional 265 feet to the north in order to encompass the vehicle turning movements at and near 11th Street in the town of Gregory. The city of Gregory requested this change to reduce the speed and enhance safety for turning movements from vehicles at that 11th Street intersection with Highway 47. And after a spot speed study and review of the location, the DOT concurred with the request, as did the Highway Patrol. And at the hearing, no comments for or against were received from the public. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for the presenter? Questions for the Department of Transportation. Are there any other proponents? Any other proponents? If there are no other proponents, are there any opponents of this rule? Any opponents? There are no opponents of the rule. I do have a question. What was the speed limit in that area?
Mr. Chairman, there's a 30-mile-an-hour speed limit in the middle of town. It then goes headed north to 45 miles an hour. What this change will do is would extend the 30-mile-an-hour zone and thus further push back the start of the 45-mile-an-hour zone.
So it was 45 previously. That's what I was looking
yes,
for.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, we'll close it to public testimony and open it up for action and or discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I move to pass.
It's been moved by Representative Gibson and seconded by Senator Hunhoff, I believe. No second. It was Senator Buell. I heard a comment over there. So, all right, seconded by Senator Buell. Any comments on that motion?
No, I agree with the rule change.
There are no further comments. Secretary will call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay.
Buell.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Torno.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Valley.
Aye.
Motion carried.
The rule will be approved as written. And at this point, I will turn the gavel back to the chair.
Well, thank you, committee. We're only 15 minutes past noon. That's doing very well. Thank you so very much for your attentiveness, and we were able to go through our agenda. Our next meeting is which date?
June 7th,
and we have quite a long agenda for that day, and we're looking at starting at 8:15 and going till 3:30. We'll do that versus do it at the sites? We have DDN until 3 o'clock, so we have to make sure that we get done. I looked at the list. Is there any that you think, you know, we did come to peer today because we felt there were some that we wanted to have a physical presence? Are any of those rules?
The Attorney General's office, I think, will have their interlock device rules, but after that, I don't see any that indicate, you know, extensive public comment or controversy.
Okay. Thank you. Is it still the preference of this committee, then, that we meet by, I call it PICTEL, it's not DDN site? Is that all right? All right, then we'll plan for the next meeting DDN, then. Representative Gibson, will that work for you?
Yes, if I could remember, Senator Hunhoff.
That's quite okay. I have those brain farts every once in a while, so I can appreciate. So then we will plan to meet DDN, and we will start at 8:15 or 8:30.
We'll try to connect at 8:15.
Okay. You didn't probably hear Chris. We'll try and connect at 8:15, and we'll start at 8:30 then.
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. Anything else or anything from the committee members? No? I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
I so move.
Moved by Representative Gibson, second by Senator Buell. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Again, thank you very much for a great meeting.
Thank you.